Well, many thanks to Kelly and Yves. There's been a little kind of some strange back and forth about the coordination of this talk today, and I'm very grateful to them with bearing with that. One of the things that we corresponded about was that there's a need to have some sort of a public forum at York around the NAFTA 2.0, the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, and ideally this might have been a panel involving some other colleagues, but that didn't happen, so we hope that can happen with other people, not me, sometime later. But I will try to say a little bit about what I know about that, which is, of course, very limited, given that, so far there's some uncertainty about various aspects of that agreement, but it is clearly pertinent to this research. So the paper draws primarily on a recent article that I published with my colleague Aleida Hernandez-Cervantes, who's at the UNAM, on Canadian involvement in the reform of the Mexican energy sector, implemented sort of most aggressively since 2013, and also some earlier work with my colleague Sonia Kaloran McKibben, who has now gone to work for UFA, looking at the relationship and the sort of interconnection between what we term as extractivism and productivism, so that one needs to think about extractive industries very much alongside the organization of labor. And so I've been trying to do that, but as somebody who's not sort of, doesn't have formal training in labor studies, I'll be very grateful to get sort of the critique of people who do have that, including folks like Kelly and all of you and Steve. So that's sort of part of the talk today. The other thing is that, preparing for this talk, one of the things that had been considered was perhaps a talk with my colleague Liette Gilbert about some work that we've been doing on auditing around transport in the oil and gas sector in Canada on rail and pipeline. And I had thought, it'll be harder to make the labor connection. But on Monday, Bruce Campbell, who's the former director of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, had a book launch here at York that Liette coordinated. And one of the things that was really sort of evocative in his presentation is the way he described how the single conductor of the plane that led to the explosion, Lac Mégantic, has basically shouldered all of the risk and all of the, legal implications of that event, much to the chagrin of the community. That particular case really demonstrates the way in which industrial capital has managed to shift responsibility not only onto sort of the natural environment or onto ecology, but onto workers with sort of an increasingly aggressive approach to extraction. So I think it actually would have been a great case, and maybe for future discussion around that. So this particular presentation revolves around the 2013 Mexican energy sector reform, which has had a couple of decade lead up. But what I've tried to do here is to connect that directly, which is easy to do because they are directly connected, with the layoff of 40,000 workers from Lucy Fuerza, which is the basically major energy producing corporation of the Mexican state in central Mexico in 2009. And that particular event, occurred basically over a 24-hour period. The corporation was more or less dissolved and all of these people thrown out of work. 6,000 state security forces were sent to different facilities of Lucy Fuerza in central Mexico in order to secure their terrain, knowing that workers were going to react very strongly to the sort of appropriation of these spaces where they had worked. And that particular action has been part of a couple of decades of actions on the part of the Mexican state to facilitate the Mexican energy reform. Now, the Mexican energy reform basically amounts to the denationalization of an energy sector that is quite unique internationally, particularly the oil and gas sector in Mexico. Because as a result of the 1917 constitution in Mexico, and particularly the nationalization of the oil and gas industry in 1938, it was for much of the last 75 years was one of the only sectors in the world where there was a really strong restriction on foreign investment and involvement in that industry. And the 1938 expropriation of foreign oil companies revolved specifically, the companies that were expropriated, the most important ones were the subsidiary of Standard Oil, which would today be ExxonMobil, actually part of Chevron as well, Chevron Texaco as well, which was La Huasteca Petroleum Company in Mexico, and the subsidiary of what would today be Shell Oil, El Aguila. And those two firms, their expropriation and nationalization was something that was seen, you know, by kind of imperial powers, particularly by the British and the Americans, as something that would be impossible, you know, basically that Mexicans weren't going to be able to run their oil industry. But they actually did so pretty successfully. While there were sort of threats of various, both the Brits and the Americans declaring war, and in fact Canada as well, on Mexico for the expropriation, Mexico was able to sort of continue on the path of nationalizing the energy sector. In part, there was historical debate about this, but in part because of World War II, because basically at that particular moment, the British, especially, and the Americans both had other concerns, and Mexico wasn't central to them. And also, one of the views is that the Americans sort of allowed the expropriation because at that point the British had more holdings in Mexico than the Americans. The Americans had shifted, rolled out Shell, had more holdings in Mexico, Standard Oil had more holdings in Venezuela, and so by allowing the expropriation, it also was sort of part of, you know, allowing the sun to set on the British Empire, kind of at the, you know, the last stages of British to American transition in sort of imperial power. So that nationalization then meant that Mexico was actually historically and globally unique. It was distinct from later, from what became later the OPEC, the OPEC cartel. Mexico was not, you know, there's sometimes some confusion about this. Mexico was never a member of OPEC. And OPEC was really about exporting countries, whereas Mexico, one of the objectives of the 1938 nationalization was to restrict exports in order to use the petroleum for national development. So to basically, you know, for those of you who have sort of a critical development studies kind of background, to really promote the developmental state, to allow sort of the Mexican kind of national economy, partially capitalist, to, you know, to come to its full fruition. And one of the outcomes of that also was the empowerment of labor, which is sort of also a unique part of Mexican history. The so-called Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, that was in power for much of the last century in Mexico, one of the reasons it retained that power was because of the corporatist relations, as they're referred to in the Mexican literature, with unions that were very closely affiliated with the state. And so these unions have also been critiqued for corrupt relations with the state, and among them, those bodies that were seen as corrupt included the Petroleum Workers Union and the Energy Sector Union, where there were a lot of sort of kickbacks to union leadership. However, despite all of, you know, those critiques around corruption within the union sector in Mexico, those unions did manage to ensure protections on organized labor for many, many decades. One of the results of that protection on organized labor was that Mexico actually managed to employ 10 times more workers per barrel than Pemex did, than any other national oil company, for much of the 20th century. So, from the perspective of a kind of a neoliberal capitalist model, this is seen as inefficiency. But from the perspective of sort of a kind of more kind of Marxist analysis of capitalist relations, it meant that there was a greater sort of use of surplus value by workers as opposed to by state capital in this case. And so the 2009 layoffs were preceded by layoffs in the 90s of large numbers of workers from the Petroleum Workers Union as well, that also allowed for the early stages of the reform of the Mexican energy sector. So, you know, what this has been kind of a, two decade process, more or less. But the 2013 reform was particularly extreme because it allowed for the first time since 1938 foreign production of oil and gas in Mexico. This picture, López Obrador, who, those people here who might have followed Mexican politics, who was elected as president of Mexico in July from basically the sort of left-leaning social democratic party, Morena, which was an offshoot of the previous social democratic party. His election, by many sort of on the progressive left in Mexico, was seen as sort of, you know, a major victory in the context of the broader inability of left parties in Latin America to gain re-election, or the sort of onslaught by right-wing forces against them, like through the imprisonment of people like Lula in Brazil. And so López Obrador had also been a significant leader to both oil worker mobilization against privatization of the oil and gas industry, but also of campesino, of peasant populations who were negatively impacted by the oil and gas industry, particularly in Tabasco and Southern Veracruz states, dating back also a couple of decades. So he has sort of a long history. You know, there's been quite a bit of critique in the last few months in the media about López Obrador's relationship with different branches of capital and, you know, corruption among some people who have been appointed as ministers. But this is somebody who does have a long history associated with grassroots movements in the Gulf states of Mexico. So this is actually a relatively recent, a July 20th picture of a protest of the union from Lucy Fuerza, the Mexican Society of Electrical Workers, calling for the renationalization of the industry. So one of the things that López Obrador has said he will do is reverse the 2013 reform of the Mexican energy sector. Since his election, and even, you know, basically within a day of his election, there's been backtracking on this, and this is sort of unsurprising because it's frankly quite unlikely that various capital fractions, both in Mexico and the U.S. and Canada for that matter, would have sort of permitted free and fair elections in Mexico if they really thought López Obrador was going to fully reverse the Mexican energy reform. And I'll speak a little bit more about why that is soon. But there still are various ways in which social movement groups are trying to influence what will happen once López Obrador takes office in December. So, you know, the other governmental members have now entered into Congress and Senate, but he doesn't actually become formally the president until December the 1st, although his appointees were involved with the most recent negotiations of NAFTA 2.0. So one of the things that the SME, that the Electrical Workers Union is calling for, and that various social movements in Mexico is calling for, is sort of a kind of public consultation on the energy reform. I don't think it's all that likely that they'll be successful in these demands, but I mean, there is, you know, there's quite a bit of, Mexico has a long history of popular mobilization around the oil and gas industry, and so, you know, this isn't going to, that kind of mobilization will sustain itself. I mean, this is sort of a sort of iconic photo of how in the, at the time of nationalization of the Mexican energy sector in the 30s, one of the things that sort of unified class fractions in Mexico was an anti-imperialist, kind of anti-American and position about energy specifically. And so this is a picture of Mexico City of sort of middle-class women coming to drop off jewelry or whatever they could to help finance the expropriation of the oil industry, to help pay back some of the funds to the companies that were having their installations nationalized by the state. And so, you know, this is also very much, you know, a part of sort of Mexican nationalist imagery, is this kind of unified action on the part of workers and peasant groups and indigenous people, which in practice, you know, has suffered from many different kinds of ruptures, right? So certainly indigenous populations in Mexico would have problems with this sort of general imagery, but it's very much part of Mexican national identity, this idea of the sort of unified position of kind of the Mexican nation state, especially around kind of natural resources, around food sovereignty, around energy sovereignty, around territorial sovereignty in light of kind of American, especially, aggression. And here, you know, I mean, on the left, Pemex, the Mexican oil company, has had a long-standing campaign about Pemex in the house. So basically, you know, the national products, consumer products that come out of the oil and gas industry, those are all the, you know, the pictures in yellow of all the things that come out of your national industry that are produced here locally because of the nationalization of the industry. On the other side is a picture that took many years ago in Minatitlan, which is one of the sites of one of the historic refineries in Mexico, at the annual March commemoration of the nationalization of the industry on March 18th. So the picture above there is Lázaro Cárdenas, who was the president who nationalized the industry, and I just think it's kind of ironic because of the Ford on the side right behind him. Like it sort of represents a little bit of the constant kind of power of American capital that's, you know, influenced the ability of various social forces in Mexico to kind of create more, you know, substantive nationalization of different industrial sectors. So this comes from the Facebook page of the Union of Professional Petroleum Workers in Mexico, which is a group that some of their leadership are people who, one person in particular passed away a few years ago. He and his spouse were sort of my kind of mentors when I was doing my field research in Mexico 15 years ago. And so they have been, that particular group of workers sought to have sort of an independent union that was critical of the reform processes within Pemex. It was made up of a lot of people who were pro-nationalists, many sort of on the left, who were trying to kind of intervene in what they saw as neoliberal processes that were being implemented by you know, the upper echelons of Pemex administration, which included, for instance, one of the former senior administrators was the campaign manager for Peña Nieto, the former president of Mexico, who then had to flee the country on charges of corruption related to the Odebrecht scandal that involves a big Brazilian multinational. But I mentioned that particular scandal in that it turns out later, that came up through research I did later, that particular scandal was actually directly connected to Canada's Export Development Canada, because the support to the Peña Nieto campaign through the Odebrecht subsidiary went through a major petrochemical project in southern Veracruz state, the Etileno 21 petrochemical project, which is in the area where I've done most of my field research, which was a Brazilian-Mexican co-partnership. And one of the main financiers for that plant, which is the largest petrochemical plant in the Americas, is Export Development Canada. So last year, some colleagues at an NGO in Ottawa called Above Ground, who sort of follow the activities of Export Development Canada and seek sort of more transparency in their actions, you know, we sort of started, you know, looking at this a bit more closely. And the relationship that Export Development Canada had with that project, which it's later came out, was a project that directly supported Peña Nieto's election campaign, implies that Export Development Canada was only, you know, a couple steps removed from that corruption. So, you know, above ground's view is that we cannot make the direct connection because the formalization of the Export Development Canada financing to that big petrochemical project came after Peña Nieto had been reelected. But, you know, presumably there would have been at least 6 months of negotiations for Export Development Canada to finalize its financing to that project. So there is sort of a direct kind of implications for the Canadian state for this. Seems to have frozen. Let's see. Maybe I can just go like this. Okay. So one of the major outcomes of the reversal of the kind of nationalization of the Mexican energy sector, and one that has been really sort of, you know, kind of rapidly increased since 2013, is around the amount of Mexico's electricity that is generated from imported natural gas. So I included the image with the blue, the pie graph, in part because of a question that Greg Albo had asked me some, I don't know, 5 months ago about how much of Mexico's energy was produced through gas and how much was produced, or how much was through coal and how much was through oil products prior to the nationalization. So it turns out that the majority of the electricity generation has always been in, you know, oil-fueled power plants, some coal, but it was primarily oil, so primarily Mexican product. And so what has happened now is that the fossil fuel component that is from natural gas has been on the upswing. And so you can see, you know, in 2013, the constant kind of increase in natural gas is an overall element of Mexico's electricity generation. And so what is sort of most key here is that as of, you know, late 2016, there was basically a reversal of the relationship between exports and imports of Mexican natural gas to the U.S. So, you know, as I said earlier, one of the things that was the result of the 38 nationalization was that Mexico did not export energy for a long time. But from the 70s onwards, and especially from the 80s, Mexico did start to, in the first rounds of sort of energy reform, did start to export fuel, petroleum products to the U.S. And among the various controversial projects was the fact that offshore Mexican heavy oil was being refined at a Shell refinery in Texas and then being imported back into Mexico. So that rather than the value added and the refining happening in Mexico, it was happening in the States. So, you know, there's been considerable exports of various Mexican energy products since the 80s especially. But what is really notable here is that the overall dependence on Mexico of imported natural gas for its own electricity generation reversed just a couple of years ago. And, you know, because of the use of language around sovereignty in Mexico's sort of approach to its natural resources, so language around food sovereignty that actually came out, I realized quite recently, of Mexican government sources, not out of the alternative food movement, as many of us have thought. But, you know, the language around sovereignty that was very much part of it, now, you know, pretty class characteristic of, say, food sovereignty movements and local food movements and national food movements, is also applied by groups like the professional petroleum workers unions and by the alternative oil workers union in Mexico to understanding energy generation. And so what has been the result of the reform is that there is an increasing, there's now, you know, considerable dependence of Mexico on imported U.S. natural gas for electricity generation. Here you see, you know, how that really took off, you know, in the period leading up to the Mexican energy reform and specifically from the Mexican energy reform. Thereafter. So there's been, you know, considerable interests in the energy reform in the U.S. in part because of the fact that the U.S. itself is sort of moving from being, having been a net importer of energy to an exporter. And here Canadian and Mexican markets are really important. My colleague Aleida, she's a feminist legal scholar, and her work focuses on a sort of framework of juridical pluralism, which in its progressive form, the concept of juridical pluralism is usually applied to, say, the use of indigenous and non-indigenous legal forms side by side. Like in Canada, that's the term that judicial pluralism usually is used to describe. That's the kind of practices. But the kind of work that that Aleida does focuses on what she calls juridical pluralism of sort of international agencies. So the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Inter-American Development Bank. So her work is sort of focused on the ways in which these different transnational bodies have, you know, the role that they play in reforming national laws and sort of the intersection between different kinds of transnational legal mechanisms, including things like investor-state dispute systems, which are very much part of NAFTA and which remain in play for Mexico in the NAFTA 2.0, although they've been taken out of the U.S.-Canada agreement, supposedly. You know, that those are parts of this broader set of legal mechanisms that allow what she calls sort of juridical structures of dispossession. So the way in which the kind of transnational law allows for the expropriation of public goods. And so following sort of Aleida's methodology, we looked at a series of, access to information and privacy requests and through documentation produced by the Canada-Mexico Energy Partnership, which is basically a bilateral kind of relationship between Canada and Mexico around the reform of the Mexican energy sector, at the different kinds of bodies that are involved with, you know, shaping the not just the actual production of the law, but the implementation of the Mexican energy reform through specific kinds of workshops and things. So, you know, the Canada-Mexico partnership, the journal didn't like that. They felt that this was kind of too sloppy. But anyways, they did still publish it. So they felt that there should have been more kind of, that the size of the different cells should have sort of reflected more adequately their relative power and so on. But anyway, so we sort of tried to blow up kind of, you know, Canada's national energy partner in Pemex and the Mexican National Congress, since they are kind of slightly more significant players in the implementation of the energy reform. But, you know, one of the things we looked at are the relationship between these different actors. So among them, in Alberta, the University of Alberta, the University of Calgary, and the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology have all been involved with these different kinds of training programs with restructured Mexican energy regulating institutions to bring best practices to Mexico. And I mean, as we could tell you, you know, the idea that Canada is bringing best practices to Mexico in energy regulation is extremely alarming. Canada is not a country that should be used as a model for energy regulation by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, one could argue, I mean, I was stunned some years ago to find out, for instance, in southern Mexico, that there were only a couple of independent monitors for the whole offshore oil and gas operations in Ciudad del Carmen in Campeche State, only to find out that there were basically the same number of, you know, staff doing the same work in Alberta a few years later. So we're not an exemplar of how this kind of regulation of the industry should be done. And in fact, you know, as many environmental NGOs and as many kind of critical observers of the Canadian oil and gas industry have pointed out, even predating the Harper government, the sort of revolving door between regulators in the National Energy Board and in the Alberta Energy Regulator and the oil and gas industry, you know, was just very apparent. There's just a constant relationship between them. So you see, you know, the National Energy Board is also being used, various aspects of what the National Energy Board does is also being used as the as models for what the Mexican Energy Secretary, the new Sener, will do. Among the things that we found through the the access to information and privacy requests was that Canada had given a workshop through the Canada-Mexico partnership. People from TransCanada Pipelines had given a workshop to Mexican regulators about so-called right of way in the context of gas pipeline construction in Mexico. And so it's in the area of pipeline construction that Canada has particular interests. So one of the things that, you know, over the last few years, I was doing some research on the amount of money that Export Development Canada was giving to Canadian oil and gas firms. And initially, when I started this research, I was looking actually particularly for Export Development Canada financing to oil and extractive industry in sub-Saharan Africa. But what came out of that research was, in fact, that Export Development Canada was financing a lot of Canadian activities in the United States, which in principle goes against the mandate of Export Development Canada, which is supposed to be, you know, historically kind of global south-related investment in supposedly risky locations. But the pipeline sector is now considered increasingly high risk because of the problem of right-of-way, which basically means people saying that they don't want a pipeline built on their land. Indigenous people or farmers or different kinds of landowners not wanting a pipeline on their in their territory. And so the, you know, the sheer extreme sort of figures of Export Development financing to TransCanada were then sort of matched after 2013 to the amount of funds that Export Development Canada was sort of channeling towards Canadian investor activity in partnership with Petróleos Mexicana, with Pemex, and with the Mexican Federal Electrical Commission. And you know what's been difficult. To find out because of the very sort of restricted access to information that Export Development Canada allows is precisely which activities, precisely what this kind of financing is doing. You know, what specific project. But you know, the overall implications of this is major sort of federal corporate subsidies to Canadian capital investment in the U.S. and in Mexico in the energy sector. And so, you know, in sort of reviewing the implications of the possible renationalization of the Mexican energy industry in Mexico, I was sort of looking at, you know, the way Mexico, or the way Export Development Canada conceives of political risk. Political risk is considered the second biggest barrier to investing in emerging markets. Might be hard to read up there. And the different bubbles that are hard to see. Number one is adverse regulatory changes, which you can imagine what an adverse regulatory change is for the oil and gas and pipeline sector. It's certainly not one that's about sort of protecting people who live in the vicinity of those industries. The second one is the not honoring of guarantee. Sorry, the second one is the breach of contract, which again is, you know, something that. But both of these are things that would result from the renationalization of the Mexican energy sector. The third is currency convertibility restrictions, and then it goes on from civil disturbance to not honoring of guarantees. Number six is expropriation or confiscation. Number seven is terrorism, and number eight is war. So you know, the highest political risk that industry faces is adverse regulatory changes. And so one of the things Export Development Canada does is provide you with insurance in the case of an adverse regulatory change. So clearly Export Development Canada, which is a Crown corporation, has an interest in not having to pay out the risk financing that it's given in the various billions of dollars to the pipeline industries that are very much involved with constructing the network that's importing all of that U.S. natural gas into Mexico. So these are just, you know, images from different Mexican media sources of mobilizations of community members, so civil disturbances of different kinds, against large gas pipeline projects with TransCanada backing in Mexico. And this has happened. It's happened in the north of the country. It's happened in the central part of the country, and it's also happened on the Gulf Coast because there's an underwater pipeline being constructed between Texas and Tuxpan, Veracruz, and so. One of these particularly. Which is an area that I'm hoping to do more field research during my sabbatical, whenever that will be, is in the fishing communities in northern Veracruz state that are very concerned about the implications of this submarine gas pipeline between Texas, this TransCanada pipeline that is shipping gas in from Texas. American natural gas, U.S. produced natural gas from Texas, Canadian pipeline into Mexico. So this is an image of the TransCanada-Mexico operations. TransCanada, their assumptions was that by 2018, I think now it's 2019, they're supposed to be operating 7 major natural gas pipeline systems in Mexico, representing approximately U.S. $5 billion investment. And the impetus, you know, from the perspective of sort of the regulation of capital, the implications of this arise from mobilization against the oil and gas industry in Canada and the United States. So, within a couple of years of the petroleum reform in Mexico, the Canadian business press started to cover the fact that Canadian pipeline firms, Enbridge to a lesser extent, but TransCanada specifically, were looking at Mexico as a place to kind of put all this, unfixed capital, basically, that was not being used because of halted or paused pipeline projects that were opposed due to opposition within Canada and the U.S. The broader context here dates back, much as a lot of the debate now focuses, for instance, on the particular protectionist measures of Bush, or previously under the Harper regime, a lot of the regulatory demands and concerns in Canada focus specifically around the positions of the Harper government. I mean, this is very much a part of sort of neoliberal capitalist kind of operations. And so, one of the things that Mexico signed also in the period leading right up to the Mexican energy reform was a transboundary agreement on offshore oil and gas in the areas beyond national jurisdiction between the U.S. and Mexico in the Mexican Gulf. The cartoon there is, so now I'm, chose the sort of, this is from Mexican media, kind of quintessential sort of, Campesino in the sombrero saying, now the one thing I want to know is what else are we going to give to the Yankees? What else do we have left to give? So what that particular agreement was about concerned this area in the U.S. And Mexico sort of donut holes that are sort of beyond state jurisdiction in the Gulf of Mexico. And what they did in 2012 is come to an agreement that would allow exploitation of these areas. And one of the other places where Canadian firms have benefited is as subcontractors to some projects and partners to some projects involving the oil and gas industry, U.S. oil and gas interests in, further development of the Gulf of Mexico in these transboundary areas. So, it was clear, more than a year ago, that, there was joint interest on the part of private oil and gas industry in the United States, Canada, and Mexico on renewal of NAFTA. And so here, this is a particular comes from a position paper put out by the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, the American Petroleum Institute, and the relatively newly formed AMEXI, which is the Mexican Association of Hydrocarbon Companies, which are basically all three of these are corporate lobbies for the private oil and gas industry. And one of the things that in the paper that Leda and I just published, what we refer to is the fact that all that, you know, members of representatives of all three of these senior representatives from all three of the API, CAP, and AMEXI were people who, you know, actually worked in the U.S., Mexican, and Canadian state. So the relationship, you know, had various kinds of cabinet positions in different governments. In the, I think it was either Bush 1 or the Reagan administration, the former API head. You know, so they, basically I can look up the specific names of who was doing what, but the point is that there's a very close connection between state regulators and you know, governments and the lobbies for the oil and gas industry, private oil and gas industry in all three countries. One of the things that all three of the lobbies called for was the preservation of investor-state dispute settlement, including rules that restrict expropriation of investments and that provide for prompt, adequate, and effective compensation if expropriation does occur. And so basically, What seems to be the outcome of the new NAFTA 2.0, the USMCA, is that investor-state dispute settlement, which was actually opposed by the Republicans, you know, in those strange moments when, you know, Trump and Sanders kind of policies would overlap, right? You know, on the grounds that these give too much power to capital to invest overseas, or to take advantage of, you know, to take advantage of your national economy. What seems to be the case is that investor-state dispute settlement is being preserved in the Mexican context with the oil and gas industry. So under the new NAFTA 2.0, it's been removed, as I understand it, from the U.S.-Canada portion of the relationship, but it has been made part of the energy relationship with Mexico. And it's hard to find, actually, because at least the existing text that's available does not have a separate chapter on energy. Canada, you know, if you look on the Canadian website, it says specifically the energy provisions are sort of scattered throughout the different sections of NAFTA, which, you know, I'm sure is kind of deliberate, frankly, so that it's harder for people to figure out precisely what's going on around energy, which is, you know, particularly controversial in this picture. So we're now at 3, and I could go on, but I think I'll okay. This is just the Transcan. So this is just the most recent Mexico financing available on the Export Development Canada website that I sort of just went through their disclosure stuff over the last couple of days to see what was new. And you know, some of them are obviously around the energy reform, so specifically financing to the Federal Electoral Commission. But then there's these other bodies like this Signux, which is, you know, one of these bodies that sort of acts as a financier of other activities. You know, the way kind of corporations use sort of, I mean, there's investing groups that kind of do things on the part of other sectors, they're harder to kind of, you have to look them up to find out what they do to see whether or not they're involved in the energy sector. So that will involve some more digging on our part, Alita and I, for sort of subsequent work. But it just, you know, this is sort of an ongoing concern in terms of the way Canada's financing investment in the Mexican energy sector under the reform section. You know, just ending it with one of the more recent protests. This is in northern Mexico in Chihuahua State, against TransCanada pipelines not having negotiated with the right-of-way model from the Canadian
context is being used now as a model for Mexico in terms of, you know, adequate consultation with indigenous people. Here being very sarcastic, right? Because we've obviously faced these kinds of problems within the Canadian context, and now best practices are being exported to Mexico in this area. So that's that. So thank you, Kelly.